So what does wellness mean to you?
Welcome to another episode of Wellness Wednesdays. I am your host, Eric Collard. This week, another special guest. This gentleman I've been following on social media and in print for the last few years. Fairly influential writer. If you're a runner or an athlete, especially in Canada, he's an author, a journalist. He's now moved to Outside Magazine. Welcome to the podcast, Alex.
Thanks, Eric. It's great to be here.
You've got a brand new book. We're going to kind of tease a little bit, but I think we're going to get you back on and talk to really go in depth on it because it's such a cool subject and it's such aligned with the stuff that I've been saying. There's so much to get up to speed on before we talk about that. So can you, for the folks at home, can you give us kind of how do you get from doing a PhD and running and then becoming now probably one of the top fitness or wellness writers in the country, if not the continent?
Well, thanks for the kind words. In terms of how I got where, you know, from A to B, it was definitely not a planned route. It's not like I sat down in high school and thought, well, I'll spend 10 years doing physics and then I will suddenly become a journalist, but I won't write about physics. I'll write about sports. That it kind of evolved along the way. So just to give some background on myself. So yeah, I studied physics as an undergrad and then I did a PhD in physics and actually worked for a couple of years as a postdoctoral researcher with the US National Security Agency in quantum computing. All of that stuff was like, it was interesting, but it was never quite clicked for me. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And I knew that, it was interesting, but the story I often remember when I'm trying to explain why on earth I did it is, you know, when I was a postdoc, we would work long hours in the lab, you know, maybe 14, 16 hours, and I'd go home and get some sleep, come back the next morning. And some of the other guys I was working with would be like, "Hey, Alex, did you read the article in Physics Today about such and such a thing?" And I'd be like, "Are you kidding me? I was here at the lab for 16 hours. The last thing I want to do when I go home is read more physics." But for some of these other guys, that's the way it was. They loved it. They had such a passion for it that they, after 16 hours, they'd go home and read more about it. So that was kind of a light bulb for me that I wanted to do something with my life that I was passionate enough about that I was just eager to do more, no matter, you know, that I wish there were more hours in the day that I could do it. And so in parallel with all the time I'd been doing physics, I was also running competitively through high school, then through university at McGill. And then I ran for the Canadian national team. I never made the Olympic level, but I was kind of a tier or two below that, running at the World Cross Country Championships and some other international competitions as a distance runner. So I kind of had these two. I had a lot of experience in science and I had a passion for sports and for endurance and things like that. So in my late 20s, it was kind of a leap into the unknown. I decided to go back to school and do a master's in journalism. I didn't really have any experience in journalism. I didn't know that I was going to like it, but it sounded like in my dreams, it sounded like a possible way that I could spend time looking into, you know, the science of sport and things like that and other areas that I like outdoor adventure and, you know, travel and music and things like that. So I did my journalism degree. I spent a year actually a year and a half at the Ottawa Citizen as a general assignment reporter, kind of learning the trade, writing hundreds of stories, literally writing about car crashes and dog fashion shows and things like that. And then eventually went freelance and again, started out writing about anything that I could, that would pay the bills. I certainly, you know, my first contact as a freelancer was with The Bottom Line, which is Canada's accounting newsletters. I'm sure everyone knows.
It's a hot read.
Yeah. Still the top read for accountants, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, gradually I was able to start, taking advantage of some of my experiences, writing some stories about sports, about endurance, about running. And eventually I got into the, not so much writing about, you know, who wins and who loses in sports, but about why, which was something that connected to my own experiences as an athlete, trying to understand, you know, what my limits were and where they came from. And so that was about, say, 2006, 2007, as I started writing more about the science of sport. And it's just been a long gradual process since then of and not in, not necessarily an intentional process of specializing. This was just one interest among many, but it was clear that it was something that I was interested in and good at, and began to build more and more expertise until, you know, now I would say if I had to describe my career, it's like, yeah, I'm a journalist. In particular, I'm a science journalist, and in really particular, I'm like a science of endurance journalist. That's most of what I write about these days. So that's the long answer. It was never premeditated, but it ended up sort of taking advantage of both my science background and my sports background, and kind of tying into my interests and my passions.
That's awesome. So before we kind of go into a little more in depth, what events did you run at, or what were your best events?
So objectively speaking, my best event probably was the 1500 meters. So, you know, just shorter than a mile. Yeah. I ended up running 3:42, which is, that was in my last year at McGill. And if you know, depending on which conversions, if you look at the official IAAF conversion tables, that's equivalent to a 400.03 mile, which is one of the great tragedies and regrets of my life that I didn't run a sub 4 minute mile. I also ran internationally in cross country, which is a 12K race. And later on, I actually ran at the World Mountain Running Championships and things like that. And I did road running too. And in a perfect world, if I'd gotten everything right, had avoided some injuries, done things right, I think I was probably built to be a pretty good 5,000 meter runner. And I did end up running 13:52, but I don't think I ever really ran as well as I could have at 5,000. But anyway, so yeah, middle distance is probably where my best results were. And I was probably long middle distance is where I could have been maybe a little better. And in later years, I've run one marathon, and it, you know, I can say from that experience, I can say I was probably built for a middle distance, not for long distance. My stride is pretty bouncy and not optimized for the long distances. It was a long and punishing. It was the Ottawa Marathon, actually. And that last 10K was pretty long.
Yeah. And I'm sure you still beat most people's time, but it's funny how when you're a former, you know, high performance athlete, you compare yourself to the high performance athletes of in that distance. And even though it might not be your best, it's still probably better than 99% of the people out there. So.
Well, you know, all of us compare ourselves to what we think we're capable of. So it's like, you know, everyone has a, you know, the times are almost irrelevant. You kind of, especially if you've been running for a while, you kind of know what you should be capable of. And so, you know, you can be near the back of the pack, but if you ran a great race relative to what you thought you were capable of, you're super proud of it. And similarly, you can be near the front of the pack, but if you know it was a disappointing performance relative to your capabilities on that day, then you might end up frustrated with it. And so, yeah, for the marathon, I kind of had a sense of what I should be able to run. the body doesn't always cooperate with these grand ideas in your head.
Yeah, it's funny because we kind of had, parallel careers, not in the running, because I'm not a world-class runner by any means of imagination, but I've dealt with a couple of runners. One, I was at the University of Windsor. We had a very good track team back then, won CIS championships, and some of our runners we chatted before, you got to run with or got to be part of some of the national teams with. And also as a PR guy, you probably called me. I used to work at City Hall. You probably called me over the years to ask about some car crash or some broken water main. So but it's nice to finally chat, and especially to chat about stuff that you're interested in.
Not car crashes.
Yeah, no. I mean, there's nothing wrong with car crashes, and I still deal with them on a regular basis. But it's nice to talk about some of the stuff you're passionate with. Speaking of that, how does your research background, your PhD, help you in your day to day now?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, one of the things that I didn't expect is that I almost never write about physics directly for a variety of reasons. One of which is that physics is really complicated and hard to write about. But so it's not like, you know, I read about the science of endurance, but I don't spend a lot of time being like, well, Newton's third law says this, and therefore I know that that's incorrect. I don't actually directly use my physics in a lot of ways, but I think there's a mode of thinking that that you come away with if you've done like science training. And it's not only people who've studied science who have this mode of thinking. That's the way their brains work. They're very skeptical. They're very analytical. They want to understand the evidence. And so I think that has stuck with me, along with, there's some other things like just comfort with looking at numbers, looking at equations, looking at complicated academic papers, and not panicking even if I don't understand what's going on. Learning how to read a scientific paper, learning how to call up scientists and just getting them to explain things to me. And when I don't understand it, getting them to explain it to me again. And just trying to make sure that when I'm, anytime you're writing about some fairly complex science, you're always doing a simplification. Like it's always, you have to simplify in order to try and convey it to people. But it's always the challenge is trying to simplify without, make it as simple as possible, but not simpler, which I guess it's an Einstein quote. So finding that right balance between simplifying and oversimplifying. So I think the experience of science was helpful in just forming a frame of mind. And then also, as I said, just being comfortable, dealing with numbers and equations and things like that you have to be able to kind of sort through in order to read some of these scientific papers.
Yeah, I think having a fairly open mind and being inquisitive, I think, is a great thing, especially for a journalist, for anyone. I think also the fact that you do have a bit of background gives you a little bit more clout when you're interviewing people. You're like, you're not just some dummy that's just asking stupid questions. So it's I think it goes a long way to helping your new career.
On that point, it is interesting that the sort of credential question, because one thing I will say, so I did a master's in journalism, and with no disrespect to journalism programs, I mean, most of the really essential stuff you can learn in like a month. In some sense, what I got out of my master's in journalism is a credential as someone who's serious about journalism and who has studied it and taken the time. So people took me seriously as a journalist. Now, as a science journalist, the fact that I have a PhD in physics, like you said, it gives me a credential that the scientists are willing to take me, seriously and take a little more time and explain things, knowing that thinking that there's a greater chance that I'll actually be able to understand, what they're saying. And, in a way that kind of bothers me a little bit. And I feel like that credential shouldn't matter. And they should, if they're going to give me an interview, they should be willing to treat me seriously independent of the credential. So I don't like introduce myself as Dr. Hutchinson when I'm interviewing people.
You should.
Occasionally when I get some really patronizing responses, from people who are calling themselves Dr. So-and-so, occasionally I have to admit, I will say, yes, I do understand basic arithmetic. Actually I studied physics, it's not a good look, but the credential is something that I think shouldn't matter, but the truth is it does sometimes, and it can open doors and get scientists to step into their shoes for a moment. They often do deal with silly questions, or more seriously, they often deal with they'll get asked questions and then their answers will get totally misrepresented or distorted in the articles that appear in the paper. So a lot of them, for better or worse, are very media averse or media shy, because they've tried to explain complicated or nuanced things and had it, oversimplified it into a really stupid headline that makes all their peers laugh at them. So in that sense, the credential is kind of a bit of insurance that I can offer them. Say, look, I understand your world, and I do come from a science background, and I'm committed to getting things right. So it does help a little bit in that way, even if maybe it shouldn't.
It's always nice to have a PhD in your back pocket. It's a nice card to play. Like, oh, by the way, yeah, I do get this. I do have a PhD as well. Speaking of some of your earlier work, so what you wrote a book called Cardio or Weight, Which Should Come First. So which, tell us, can you kind of provide the cold notes? What should we do? Should we do cardio? Should we do weights? And again, because it goes back to, I work in PR. Like, it's great. I think most people don't want to read a 17-page paper on some study. They want the headline. So boil down for us. Should we do cardio or should we do weights?
Okay, so look, let me give you, even though we want the instant answer, let me give you some backstory, which is that I wanted to call that book Sweat Science. which is the name of my blog.
Yeah.
And my publisher ended up suggesting that it should be called Which Comes First, Cardio or Weights?
Yeah.
Fitness Myths, Training Truths, and Other Surprising Discoveries from the Science of Exercise, which is like the world's longest title.
Yeah.
But the other problem with it is that Which Comes First, Cardio or Weights? When you call a book that, it really implies that you have a good, simple, straightforward answer. And after that book came out, the book came out in 2011, and I did, you know, I don't 50 or 60 radio interviews and other types of interviews after the book came out. And like 95% of the interviews start with that question. It's like, so tell us, which comes first, cardio or weights? And I'm like, oh man, the problem is the answer is complicated. And that's not what you want to hear on like a 5-minute radio interview on morning talk radio. They want the answer. They don't want like, well, actually, when you consider various factors, it depends. So, but unfortunately that's the answer, right? Well, I mean, okay. The simple answer, the simple, like very, easy takeaway is both. You should do both.
Okay.
You need to do cardio and you need to do weights. They're both very important. You can do them in different doses. I mean, you can get a reasonable cardio workout from doing circuit style weight training, and you can get some reasonable strength training from doing certain types of cardio, like, you know, hill workouts and things like that. So it's not like you have to do every kind of exercise there is, but of course we all need functional muscular strength, and we all need aerobic, like, or cardiovascular fitness. And in fact, what the title was really referring to was the sort of perennial question of, well, if I'm doing a workout, which should I do first in the gym? What should I start with? And the answer to that is, when I wrote the book, there was a bunch of research that was starting to come out on molecular signaling that suggested that your body has trouble switching instantly from strength training adaptations to resistance training or to endurance training adaptations. So if you start by doing strength, you're going to be kind of blocking the signals for endurance if you then do an endurance workout, and vice versa. So the thinking was you should start with whichever workout's more important to you, independent of the fact that you'll be, like, for one thing, you'll be fresher for that workout, but you'll also get a little bit stronger metabolic or you know, cellular signaling to adapt to that part of the workout. There's the picture is starting to look a little murkier on that. It's now that there's definitely some truth to that, but what it now appears is that it's easier to you don't have to worry about your endurance gains. You'll always, if you do a good endurance workout, you'll generally always get a good result from it. Your strength gains are what are a little more sensitive to what else is going on. And in particular, if you're low on calories, if you do an hour run and then you head to the gym right away, it's okay. But if your body is kind of depleted of energy, then even if you do the strength workout, the signals for muscle building will be a little bit compromised. So if you really want to actually build muscle, you have to kind of either spread your workouts apart a little bit or do the strength workout first, or pay attention to really refueling as quickly and as early as possible after the endurance part of the workout if you're trying to combine the two together. So anyway, that's like 10 times longer an answer than you wanted for the very simple question. But from a health perspective, overall, you want to do both. And in terms of the order, I actually think the effects are pretty subtle. So unless you're like training for a marathon and also get ready for a Mr. Olympia contest or whatever, you probably don't need to stress about it too much, and you can do whichever is most convenient and most, fits best into your schedule.
So which one do you do first?
Well, it's interesting. So, you know, so the last thing I was just saying there is that do whichever is most convenient and yada, yada. What I've found lately, I do my resistance training at a sort of, there's a local park near me that has, you know, body weight, the pull-up bars and dip bars and benches and step ups and stuff like that. So I do a lot of my strength training combined with a run in that sense. And I do it first just because I do my strength training and then I go and then continue on for my run. That's not necessarily how I would program it from a, it does make sense in terms of making sure that I have more trouble building strength than endurance. So that's one reason I would do the strength first. But for really, really what it comes down to me, and the thing that trumps it for me, and I think is worth bearing in mind, is just what makes it easiest for me mentally. And the thing is, I have no trouble getting out for a run. I've been doing that for 25 years and I enjoy the runs. So I know it's not like a mental struggle for me to get out the door and go running. Doing the resistance training is more of a mental struggle for me because I enjoy it less. For whatever reason, I see, you know, the gains are less, come less easily to me. And so I want to make sure that I'm doing the strength training while I'm fresh and before I have time to change my mind. So that if I'm planning to go for a half hour run, I don't just say, I'll just go for 40 minutes because it's a nice day. And then I'll skip the strength training, whatever. I go out, get the strength training done. And then I can say, okay, now I can just enjoy my run without having to worry about having the mental decision to try and force myself to stop before going home and do my strength training. So that's my personal situation, but I think it's actually an important thing that we can talk about, like which is 5% better or which is 5% worse from a molecular signaling point of view. But ultimately, you know, number one by far is do the workout. And so, and the number one barrier for most of us is not like molecular problems. It's, you know, time management and motivation. And so if you find a routine that works for you and it's, you know, 3% less efficient than some other routine, but you enjoy that routine and it's easier for you to do, then stick with that. And so that's kind of the principle I'm following there.
Yeah. So, I mean, a shitty workout is better than no workout. And it's one of those things that I think you're right. That motivation is key. It's about, you know, I've heard a presentation about eating that frog, you know, get the stuff that you don't want to do out of the way first. And then after that, everything becomes so much easier. Go ahead.
I was going to say that's definitely my approach. And that's definitely kind of, and it doesn't mean that it's the right approach for everyone or even anyone else, but it's a question of knowing myself and understanding what my barriers are and trying to construct a routine that works with those barriers.
And what you talk about more myths in that book. What are some of the myths about working out that everyday Canadians have?
Oh yeah, this is where I start making people angry.
I love getting angry. It gives you better workouts after.
Yeah, exactly. One of the topics I ended up doing pretty much a whole chapter on is stretching. And stretching is an interesting one because
it's one of the most controversial topics in fitness.
Totally. And there've been hundreds of studies on it. And the problem is that, you know, it's hard. My whole career is built on the idea that we can get useful information from scientific studies, but it's also important not to overestimate what we can learn from studies and not to discard what practical experience and what generations of athletes have learned too. So like there it's totally possible for a generation of athletes to get an idea in their head and believe it's helping them and for it to be wrong. So like common knowledge or collective knowledge isn't necessarily right, but you better be careful before you throw away common knowledge, because often what it turns out is two generations later, you realize, those people they were onto something. There was a benefit to what they were doing. So, I mean, to cut to the point, I mean, I was brought up like you have to stretch before exercise, otherwise you're going to get injured, and you have to stretch after exercise, otherwise you're going to be sore the next day. And both those contentions are highly debatable. There's little or no evidence. It's very, very hard. There's very, very little evidence that shows that stretching before exercise does anything other than kind of tire your muscles out and leave them a little floppier and less efficient, so hurting your performance. And there's very little evidence that stretching after exercise does anything. Like, it certainly doesn't change whether you're going to be sore the next day. The soreness that you have the next day is a result of damage to your muscles, and stretching your muscles after doesn't undamage them. The soreness has nothing to do with like lactic acid or anything that you're getting out of your muscles. So the usual explanations for why stretching is useful are pretty, I think they can be more or less dismissed. Now, that doesn't mean stretching isn't useful, because stretching does change your range of motion. So stretching, independent of when you stretch, if you do a stretching routine, it's going to keep you more flexible. And it may be certainly if you're a hockey goaltender or if you're a ballerina or whatever, stretching is non-negotiable. You need that range of motion. Now, if you're a runner, do you need range of motion? I don't know. So my answer for my own practical purposes is I haven't stretched in over a decade. You know, I used to stretch twice a day for years when I was a competitive runner. Now I don't bother, and I haven't had it. I almost never get injured. You know, it hasn't, my range of motion is lower, but I don't get injured. But if I was trying to compete seriously, if I was trying to push my limits, I might still be tempted to do some stretching, just because there may be some benefits. It's not, but the thing is with running, it's like, you don't get injured while you're doing the splits. It's not range of motion that limits you. Most runners, running injuries are just overuse or you pull something while trying to sprint, but you're in the middle of your normal range of motion. It's not like you were limited because you couldn't reach far enough. I'm trying to give a whole chapter here in one answer, but I do, before hard workouts, I do some dynamic stretching, not static stretching where you just sit and try and, you know, touch your toes or whatever and hold that motion, but where you move your legs or whatever part of the body through the range of motion that you're going to be using. So I'll do some things like high knees and skipping and walking lunges and things like that, to make sure my muscles are ready for the demands, the specific demands I'm about to put on them. So I'll do that as part of a warm up, not so much to increase my range of motion, but to make sure I'm ready, especially if I'm planning to run hard, if I'm planning to sprint and things like that. I want to make sure that I'm fully warmed up, and that dynamic stretching for me is part of that.
Yeah, you must know Blaise Dubois out of Quebec City.
Yes, yes.
And he actually, I took one of his courses, and he really brought home the point that stretching is, there's not much science behind it. So that really kind of changed the way I look at it. Not that I really ever stretched. Unfortunately, like playing sports growing up, you kind of were forced to stretch, even though, like you said, there's not much science behind it. But now I do some dynamic stretching before weights or some, but usually, especially with my chi running background, there's not much stretching to be done in the running part. It's mostly, if I'm doing a new movement that I haven't done in a while, or I do a lot of mobility work, which is kind of, and yoga, which is glorified stretching basically. So, but it's totally different. But again, I think most runners in the 70s and 80s were taught, like, if you don't stretch, you're going to get injured tomorrow. And it really brought us down, I think, the wrong path. But I think stretching overall is better than doing nothing. So it's, but again, you're right. It can hinder your gains on the road. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think, the tendency to avoid is like, so as you were saying, it's like a lot of the mythologies we were brought up with around stretching turn out to have very, very little evidence. And so the tendency sometimes is to say, okay, so therefore all stretching is crap. And I've probably been guilty of doing that, to some extent in some of my earlier articles. And I guess what I would hope is that we can, instead of going from one extreme to the other extreme, we can kind of go partway to the extreme and say, okay, so there's less evidence for stretching, doesn't seem necessarily helpful, but we have to be kind of humble about how little we still know, that the old cliche, the absence of evidence isn't the evidence of absence. So it may be that stretching has some benefits, but I haven't seen their benefits. So for me, the threshold is I don't stretch, but, if in 5 years it turns out we have a few studies showing that certain forms of stretching reduce injury or something like that, I won't be totally shocked. Like we're in a regime where we don't know the answers. And so we have to understand that all of our answers are kind of tentative and subject to change.
Yeah. I don't think we'll ever know all the answers. And again, it goes back to what you talked about earlier. It really depends on the person. If someone is a really, if they sit a lot and they have a lot of tight body parts, then maybe stretching for them is something they need to do. Whereas if most people are very active and they're runners or something that doesn't, like you said, doesn't really need to have a full range of motion, and maybe stretching is not as important as weights or some of the other stuff they can be doing. And again, it goes back to, I mean, if you're a professional athlete, your whole job is to train and recover. But if you're an average Joe or weekend warrior, you also have a job and maybe a family or other commitments. So, is that, whatever, 10, 20, 30, minutes, is it better use elsewhere? So it all comes down to that. And I like the fact that you make those, it goes back to what you like. Cause if you don't like it, you're not going to do it, regardless of how many benefits there are.
Yeah, and you're right. That's it. That the time management thing is an important point. It's like, if you have a bunch of things that may have a benefit, you have to weigh them against the other things that you could do with that time that you know have a benefit. And so it's that's probably part of my thinking in terms of stretching. It's like, it's hard enough for me. You know, I have a 4-year-old and the 1-year-old at home. Finding time to run is a challenge. And if I cut that time in half in order to do a bunch of toe touches, then I'm not sure I'm maximizing my time.
We all have many pressures. Unfortunately, a couple more questions before I let you go from this round. The you've moved on from, and it seems like your career is progressing in terms of going from bigger and bigger publication, and now you're going more to outside, which is more of a U.S. based one. Have you seen any difference between what the U.S. market wants versus what the Canadian market is looking for in terms of advice?
Oh, that's an interesting question that I haven't really thought about.
Keep giving you T-ball questions. You're a smart guy.
So off the top of my head, there's no like huge differences where I'm like, man, I can't believe the Americans are always asking me about acai juice or whatever.
Yeah.
Part of that is because the publications I work at or write for in the US versus Canada, there's a bigger difference between different publications than I think between the US and Canada, because within both the US and Canada, the people who are interested in the stuff I'm interested in, they're kind of their own niche, right? Like it's a committed marathoner in the US is very similar to a committed marathoner in Canada. Now, of course, I write for Outside. Outside's based in Santa Fe. And I hear from people who are in like Texas and New Mexico and places like that. And when I write about hydration, which is another controversial topic, of course, you know, I'll give my own experiences. It's like, dude, you know, I've been running for 25 years. I've done lots of 2-hour runs. I have never, ever carried water with me on a run other than like adventure. You know, if I'm on an adventure race where you have to carry certain survival gear, including water, with you. But if I just go for a 2-hour run, I don't carry water with me. Like there's no issue with that. But then I'll hear from people in like Houston and they're like, yeah, that may be fine for you, Canadian boy. But if we go out when it's, 40 degrees Celsius and humid and don't carry water for a 2-hour run, like we'll lose 20 pounds. And so, yeah, there are some climactic differences between the US and Canada where there's virtually nowhere in Canada where you have to deal with, at least on a prolonged basis, with just like months and months of huge heat and humidity that can, I mean, don't get me wrong, Toronto gets hot, it gets upper 30s sometimes, but you don't get the sustained multiple months where hydration is a real issue. But in terms of the sort of interests, the population in the US is a lot bigger. So I would say, maybe it's just statistical that I get more kind of crazy stuff from the US. Like, the more I've invented the new theory of running that's going to change everything, and I've got the equations to prove it, or, have you tried this, radical root of some sort of plant that's going to allow you to grow an extra leg and run faster, whatever. That stuff that I get tends to be from the US, but it may just be that the tail of the curve is a little bigger there just because there's 10 times as many people.
Yeah. I mean, we have some crazy people in Canada too. And
We got to own it. I should not pretend that we're all in the middle of the curve here.
Again, I want to be respectful of your time. I know you're a busy guy. Can you give us kind of a quick teaser on your new book, Endure? What question were you trying to answer when you came up with this book?
Yeah. So, I mean, to take a step back, the last book, Which Comes First, Cardio or Weights, it was organized in the format of 111 Q&As, and each of them was, in theory, at least practical. It was like questions that people ask each other at the gym or whatever. You know, it's like, should I stretch before exercise? How much do I need to eat after exercise? And it was really focused on the practical side of things. So the new book, Endure, I made a conscious decision to step away from that. I hope it's useful for people. I think it is. But really what I wanted to answer is, what defines the limits of human endurance? So when I go out for a run or whatever other activity the case may be, when I feel like I can't go on or I can't maintain a certain pace or effort, what is it that's slowing me down? What ultimately defines my limits? And I tried to, it's not just about running. I tried to cast the net really widely. So my definition of endurance was, the struggle to continue against a mounting desire to stop. And that's the case in running, but it's also the case in, team sports. It's also the case if you're doing your taxes. It's also the case if you're sitting through a long presentation at work. And so endurance to me ends up being a much broader concept. And the theme of a lot of the research that I end up looking at is this idea that endurance is defined by the brain, that when you reach a point where you can't go on, where you feel like you can't go on, it's not that your muscles are incapable of continuing. And if you're running a marathon at the 30K mark and a lion jumps out from behind a tree and starts chasing you, you'll find that your muscles can still go. But it's your brain that's struggling to keep sort of pushing you forward and use up that physical reserve that's available. And that mental struggle is the same one, like I said, that applies if you're doing your taxes or doing other forms, facing other forms of endurance. So the overall book is kind of an exploration in various different contexts of whether it's climbing a mountain or free diving or running or whatever the case may be. What defines the limits of endurance with specific emphasis on the role of the brain? So at the end, I think there are some practical messages that you take away that in terms of rethinking what it is that defines your limits. But it's very much a sort of a curiosity-driven book. It's telling the stories of explorers and athletes and other people who've kind of pushed the limits of endurance to the max and trying to understand how and why they're able to do that, as opposed to a sort of six-step plan for doubling your endurance or anything like that.
Well, I'm really looking forward to diving into that. Obviously I haven't done some of the other like really crazy endurance stuff, like the raid they have and the Christopher McDougall stuff, but I've done a couple of endurance races. I've done, and so it's something that's really, really interesting. I like to geek out a little bit. So I'm really looking forward to really diving in on some of this stuff. But, one thing I want to ask you one more question, actually two more questions before I let you go today. One is a question I ask all my guests on their first go round is, what does wellness mean to you?
That's a question I wrestle with on a regular basis as I sort of struggle to decide how to spend my time and what I should be aspiring to. Wellness I think for me means physical health and mental balance in the life balance in having the ability to pursue things that have meaning to me, but also, bring me enjoyment. And, as you were saying earlier, we all have demands on our time and the reason I'm answering in such a vague way is that it's like, I'm physically healthy right now and I'm happy with my career, where my career is going, but I'm also struggling with, just being so busy that I'm not sure I'm living the life that is consistent with what I think of as wellness, which is making sure I devote time to getting outside and pursuing hobbies and seeing friends and things like that. So yeah, it's physical health, but it's also a kind of life in balance so that you're not, constantly being dragged in one direction or the other rather than making conscious choices about how you want to spend your time.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunately it's a struggle that we all have to keep up with. Like there's always 900 demands of our time and we have time to do 10 of them. So it's like where do you throw your time and energy into. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. Like I said, I'd really like to get you back on to really dive into your new book. I think it's something that especially for a lot of folks that I chat with, people ask me a lot of endurance questions. So I think this will be something that's going to be really fun and informative. One more question. Where can people find out more about all the stuff that you write about? Where are the best ways to connect with you on social?
Yeah, probably the easiest place to find me is on Twitter. My handle is SweatScience. And so anytime I write a new article in any place, whether it's the Globe or outside or other places, I post it there. And I'm also often discussing things with other people. So Twitter at Sweat Science. My website is alexhutchinson.net, and that has, you know, some more biographical details and links to old stories that I'm proud of, and of course links to the new book, which I'm also proud of.
Cool. So I'll include all that into the show notes. And again, thank you so much for taking time out to explain to us some of the cool stuff you've been up to over the last decade or two. And like I said, I really look forward to getting you back on to really go in a little deeper on the new book, Endure. So, and congratulations on it. It seems like it's doing very well. I keep seeing it in, maybe I'm biased because I'm on Twitter quite often, but I keep seeing great reviews coming out for it. So congratulations on that.
Thanks a lot, Eric. And I really appreciate you having me on for the chat. It was a really interesting chat.
You've been listening to Wellness Wednesdays. I am your host, Eric Collard. Until next week, be well.